So the fact that they let me know they weren't going to be here did change a little bit what we're going to go over today. So we're going to continue some book stuff because they can read the book and follow along easier than the coding stuff. So we'll go move that to Tuesday when everybody can be here, hopefully.
Is that the first project, main project?
Yeah. Well, you'll need it for the rest of the semester, effectively, yeah. And I think it's also good to just see that there are tools out there to let you do this stuff where, you know, you're not solving these problems by hand, basically. Or you can supplement your hand calculations, that kind of thing. Okay, so we're going to start off today, do a quick review of impulse momentum since it's been 2 weeks or something since we talked about it, I guess, maybe even longer. Work a quick example of that, and then actually continue into the beginning parts of Chapter 7. Chapter 7 begins our journey through analytical methods, what are called analytical methods. So using energy instead of forces directly. So Lagrangian. We'll hopefully get to Kane's method as well. And then, so I want to get through the beginning of that so that, you know, the rest of the semester we'll be working, trying to work a problem, and then, hey, look, let's do a Newton Euler, and then, you know, I'll post the solution as well in Lagrange, and we can compare. So, impulse momentum. We have kind of both linear and rotational forms of the impulse momentum principle, right? And basically, they kind of mirror one another. I think we read that sum of forces too, yeah. Okay, so these two guys mirror one another in that we're looking at, say, for example, if PI So we have PI is a linear momentum at time TI. And we have the linear version of impulse momentum tells us, hey, that the linear momentum at time 2 is equal to linear momentum at time 1 plus this integral here. And then we have the same thing for kind of angular rotational motion, where we have the angular momentum at time 2 is the angular momentum at time 1 plus this integral. It's looking at the some of the moments over some time interval. Okay. These relationships are most useful for us when these forces or the moments coming from them are impulsive. So they're, strictly speaking, of infinite amplitude and zero duration. Practically speaking, if they are much shorter in duration than kind of the time constant of the system is one way to think about it, and fairly high amplitude. Okay. So impacts, effectively, is one thing that this is useful. Right? So, and that's one we're going to look at today. Impacts, impact testing, crash testing, those kind of things, right? Where this guy is really, really large, and this time interval, T1 to T2, is really small. Okay. What that allows us to do is say, well, basically, over that small time interval, this force is constant. So this integral becomes really easy to deal with. All right. So let's think about a very small time interval. So let's define. Time interval we're going to work over is somewhere between ti and ti plus delta t, where delta t is really small time. Okay. And what that allows us to do is say, well, that linear at time 2 is actually just ti, one instant before after ti, linear momentum one instant before is equal to the linear momentum one instant after is equal to the linear momentum one instance before plus delta t. That, where what we're saying, put in different color to emphasize it, that this force is impulsive. Okay, so this force is constant over this short duration. Okay. And we have the angular or rotational equivalent of that. We have h of a at ti. Where that sum of the moments in this case is impulsive. Okay. And these are vector equations, both of them. What shrinking this down to time basically zero does for us is also say, well, hey, over this time interval, positions or angles, things like that, configuration stuff, that there's no displacement that occurs in that time frame. So position doesn't change. That's kind of how I wrote it up here. Okay. That looked somewhat familiar from 2 weeks ago or whatever when we looked at it. And you probably saw at least this one in undergrad dynamics. And I think actually Dr. Hibbler, based on his schedule on the wall in the next room, spends like 2 weeks on this or something. So let's look at a fairly simple example. We'll set it up. We tend to do what I'm going to do then. We'll just leave that up. I think we have space to just put this over here so we don't have to rewrite all those equations. This is example 6.11 in your book. What we have is this rectangular plate. And we have this kind of ball and socket joint here. It's kind of attaching to it. Okay, and what we're going to have is a force F there. And basically what we're saying is that F is from me hitting the thing with a hammer. It's quite literally what the problem lays out. We're saying that kind of F gives a value, says 5,000 newtons. And the time interval is something like 4 milliseconds. So strictly speaking, that's not an impulsive force, right? It has some finite amplitude and duration. However, relative to the dynamics of this plate, and we said, hey, the kind of mass is 10 kilograms of that plate. It's you're given some dimensions, basically. Told that it's 360 by 360 millimeters. and actually told that the thickness is 120. Well, that's not quite the scale. It's all right. So what we want to know, that should be at the center based on how the problem is laid out. I didn't quite get there. Okay. Okay. So we have this guy laid out. We have this impulse of force, and we're saying it's a kind of an, it's initially at rest, just kind of hanging here based on that center of mass being below the. All right, that's the equilibrium state. We walk up, hit this plate with a hammer. We want to know what is the angular velocity of this plate the instant after I hit it with the hammer. Okay. So where do we start with that? Some frames and stuff. Yeah, we're always going to need those. What kind of frames make sense here? One at the center, perhaps. Well, what do we need to know? What are we going to need to know over here? Right. We're obviously going to do this stuff since we're talking about that. Right.
We're going to need to know the inertial properties.
We're going to need to know inertial properties, sure. Right, so you're going to know the moment arm around something, and you're also going to have to decide one more piece of information.
So if you need angular velocity, you need to figure out the angular momentum.
I have to figure out the angular momentum, so I'll need inertial properties. Right, if I'm going to figure out angular momentum, there's also another choice I need to make.
Yeah,
about what point. Okay. So in this case, what point makes sense? Yeah, so I could always use the center of mass if I want, right? But I also could use, right, it's in pure rotation. This is a ball joint. It's in pure rotation about that point. Let's call that guy A. So I can calculate angular momentum about that point, right? It's a fair point to use. We can get to those simplified equations. It's fixed. It's in pure rotation about that point. Okay. So if I'm going to sum moments about that point, probably want to have a frame with its origin there, right? And well, I'm probably going to want to have, I'd like to have some coordinate in the direction of F to make it easy to describe too. Well, since that's perpendicular plate, that kind of sets up a nice easy frame for us that and then Z is coming out. Right, so F is always in the Z direction. Then. So that works out pretty well for us. And then we have some angle, in this case, well, we obviously have some angle there. All right, what else do I need? So I've got a frame. I think that's going to be able to describe what we need for the most part. What else? There we go. Just be in the habit of just drawing free body diagrams, right? I think it's a good way to go. I mean, even if you end up using Lagrangian or some other energy-based method, it's you need to know what forces are is helpful, right? So I'll draw gravity on there. We'll talk about that, the role it plays here in just a second. We have the applied force F. What other forces do we have? All the reactions at A, yes. So let's draw those kind of in the positive direction in each case. Y, draw this guy, X, Z. Okay. A, Y, A, X, A, Z. And because it's a ball and socket, we don't have any moments. Reaction moments, right? Okay. What's next? I can sum forces in moments, sure. Remember, what we're really looking for, we want to know effectively that if we're looking back over at these equations. Right? We want to know this. Well, if we look at this problem and say, well, okay, that's an impulsive force relative to the dynamics of the system, we can use impulse momentum. If all we really are interested in is the angular momentum, the instant after. So how do I get there? Okay. Well, I need to know these two guys too. So we said it was at rest to begin with. So at time one is then what? Zero. And your momentum at time one was what? Zero as well. Okay, so we got part of our equation done already. All right, so how can we write, well, if we're going to form this guy, this angular momentum at time two? Well, to form that, we need to know the inertial properties, of course. What else do we need? Angular velocity. All right, so I'm going to do omega 2 for angular velocity at time 2. Okay. Well, that's for now. We don't know what that is. That's what actually what we're, you know, we're kind of looking for that piece of it. Right? These inertial properties aren't going to change. It's this that's going to be changing. So let's just write it as omega x, y, and z components in that frame we drew. And that's really what we're trying to solve for in this problem. Okay. To help us do that, we are going to need to know this guy, actually. Right. He's going to help us because we can write, and we know that's going to be, oops. It's going to be that, right? And because they're on the same rigid body, we know that's going to be zero. The pin is fixed, we know that guy's going to be zero. So we have an expression that relates the angular velocity to the linear velocity of the center of mass. This omega ends up being the same, right? Since this frame is body fixed. Okay. So we could do something like this. And we're going to say, well, hey, this that's happening over such short period of time, that position is not changing. So we have that. Okay. So we have linear velocity, we have an angular velocity. Let's look at this linear velocity. We're going to need both of these guys, actually, right? So forces acting there. Well, in this case, what is linear momentum at time 2? What's linear momentum in general? Mass times velocity. So we know that that is this. But we also know from this guy that it's this, right? what are our forces here? What forces are... Yeah, so I have... And include all those reaction forces, basically. And this, those reaction forces are why, basically, I need I'm going to need both sides of momentum. I can't work from strictly rotation. So I have in this case... And I have a numerical value for delta t given by the problem formation. Okay. So that's going to allow, you know, give me some expression, and I have these kind of three unknowns in that equation. Right. And I can set up and figure out this and start equating terms. Well, what about... Good question. So, why don't we include gravity? How big is gravity compared to that impulsive force?
Okay. Right. Very small.
Yeah, it's nothing compared to that force, right? So that's why. Okay. Right. Is that particularly acting over this small of an interval? So what that's going to allow us to do is say, well, hey, this is gravity force there, but it's so much smaller than the impulsive force of me hitting with a hammer. I'm just going to ignore that. It's going to have so little influence on the motion over this time interval that I don't care what's happening. I don't care about it right now. So we got no gravity. Is much less than the amplitude of that impulsive force. And where the limit of this is depends on what precision you need in your model, right? What precision you need in your calculation. If this is 1,000, can we still ignore it? Getting kind of closer. If it's 100, can you ignore it? Well, then you got, you know, 98 and 100, maybe you need to include it. Right? But why do the reactions get included? So we said that, hey, gravity, we know gravity is going to be much smaller than an impulsive force. We still include those reactions. Why? Yeah, so they're constraining the motion. So they're going to be as large as they have to enforce that constraint. So they can be impulsive. And they can be really, you know, be as large as they need to make that work, to enforce those constraints. Okay, so we can figure out, if we have the inertial properties and the angular velocity here, we can figure that out. Let's say, well, that's just that matrix. Let's leave it as that for right now. We also know from a similar thing, right, we had zero here, well, we also have the impulsive effects on moments about A. What are those? R cross F, right? So I need to get the position of this guy. What do we want to call that point? Let's see. Maybe C for contact point. So we have F. Okay. Right. Because we're some of the moments about looking about point A, none of those reactions show up, we just have the impulsive force. And we're ignoring gravity for the same reason we did in the force equation. So now you're going to have a system of equations and be able to solve for the resulting motion. And the math for that's in the book. Basically, work as you kind of solve these guys, you can back into what the angular momentum ends up being. Basically, have to solve this. What direction does AZ end up acting in here? Well, it's obviously in K. Is it positive K or negative K? What do you think?
Negative.
Why do you think negative?
So that it doesn't accelerate in that direction.
So we have a vote for negative, so into the board, actually.
Yes.
So I hit the hammer here, and you say the reaction force AZ is that way. You guys agree?
Where is that? Is that being hit on the edge right there? Like,
it's like the bottom corner.
Bottom corner, basically.
There's two options.
The way you posed the question made it seem like a trick question. I mean, what Ben's saying makes sense, just from like an initial thought process.
Mm-hmm.
But.
So if you think about just forces, it definitely makes sense. But we don't have just linear motion. Right? This whole system, not we have rotational stuff happening as well. Right? Think about it this way. If this guy's not pinned there, right, those reactions don't occur, what does the motion of this look like when I hit it with the hammer here? It wants to spin, and because of kind of the way it's offset, it probably wants to spin this way too. Right? I'm hitting it below the center of mass. So it wants to do this. Right? What does that tell you AZ should be? The direction of AZ should be coming this way. Right, to prevent that spin. So if you work out the math, what you'll see is it actually is same direction as F. In this case. So that's one way to do, you know, when I think about what direction constraint forces are acting, is if that constraint wasn't there, what's the motion look like? And okay, well, if the motion with the constraint looks something different, well, there has to be something acting on it in the direction to make that fix. This is a pretty common kind of problem you'll see, particularly like in a textbook, right? Hit something with a hammer, I shoot a bullet at something and it impacts, or there's a car crash or something like that. What's the actual peak forces or something like that, right? But the key thing here is that, hey, the time duration with which these things act is much, much shorter than kind of the time constant of the system you're trying to analyze. If this is acting over 4 seconds, we need to address this in a different way. All right. Questions about that? Okay. Cool. Like I said, the math, all the steps to actually solve for these things based on these parameters is in the book. Worth your time checking out, probably. All right. Chapter 7 is called Introduction to Analytical Methods. Again, what we can think of generally, mostly right, that these are kind of energy-based methods. What we also will see is that, you know, even when there are cases where they're this method is easier to use to generate an equation of motion, we often will think about the motion and try to use Newton-Euler kind of type understanding to help us better understand the system. Right, so even though it's energy-based, we're still going to draw free body diagrams and we're still going to kind of follow the basic beginning setup. Is going to look pretty similar. Okay. If we're talking about these analytical methods, we're going to need to talk about virtual work. Section 7.1.1. I will also encourage you to read the introduction to this chapter. Professor Hibbler gets a mention, or his book gets a mention at least. So this virtual work stuff is going to allow us to do a few things in these energy-based methods. Namely, look at what the generalized forces are much later. But basically, if we're going to talk about virtual work, we need to understand virtual displacements first. So that's where we're going to start. Or more generally, your book will call this virtual movements. Okay, so we have virtual movements are not just linear displacements of generalized coordinates, but also rotation. It could be rotational things. What's that? So what these are infinitesimally small motions of the system. Okay, they occur in zero time. So it's not real motion. So virtual displacement of generalized of some point P we're going to call that RP. And we'll use this kind of curly D thing to represent virtual displacements. We have virtual rotation. So let's say we have some virtual rotation through theta. Right. These are vector quantities. So kind of keep that in mind when you're thinking about these. Okay. If we define these guys this way, virtual displacement of a point is just RP, it's the change in its virtual change in its position, rotation of angle, virtual change in its angle, angular displacement. Well, then we can kind of see where the virtual work is going to come in. Right. So the work done by some of the virtual work. Or actually, we can just call it work at this point. Work done by forces at P is what?
F delta RP dot delta.
This delta?
Yeah, that delta.
Okay. I think you're in the right direction. There's more to it than that, though. That's to be the vector. And that. Some of the forces acting at that point. And remember, this is a vector equation. How about the work from the resulting moments? And let's say they're about P. Okay. So this virtual movements get us to what we are going to call virtual work eventually. Okay. And in fact, we're going to do that right now. Principle of virtual work. And we're going to start off just thinking about this statically. So, big warning sign right now, the next part of our lecture is all static. Okay. So, virtual work in the static sense, if my system is static, what kind of work's being done on it? No work. Yeah, zero. Right. Okay. So we know whatever we're getting ready to write is zero. Right. And again, big, big warning. Talking statics. I've seen this as a kind of big stumbling point for students that have sat in your spot before, even earlier in the course. Particularly students that have come through our undergrad program tend to think in statics more than dynamics. Okay, so right now we are thinking in statics, but this is going to change shortly. Right. Well, what's the, kind of talking about virtual work, well, what's the, if we have kind of a variety of different forces acting on the system, let's say we have kind of J different forces and they're acting at different points. There, I need a vector there. Okay. So I have forces acting at kind of J different places, J different coordinates. And then I have moments. And we're going to use subscript N to describe those. Where those guys are being applied. And what we're saying is that the virtual displacement Rj, that's the virtual displacement of the point at which that force is being applied. And word this a little bit. Okay. So there's our principle of virtual work for the static case. Well, how is this really helpful? What's this good for? Okay. Well, what these virtual displacements allow us to do is kind of set up a system, like they're virtual, they're not real, right? So we can set up a system that's going to allow us to look at the work done by the forces we're really interested in, and just ignore the rest of them. And the way we can do that is set up these virtual displacements and set up our system in a way such that only the forces we're interested in, the moments we're interested in, are actually doing any work. So let's consider a system. Let's see, I'm going to come back over here so we have room to kind of work this out. And I'll leave that up though. Okay. So let's just consider this linkage. And there, so we have two links. They're both length L. These guys are endpoints should be aligned. Not quite, didn't quite get it. We have angle theta. there is a force at the center of mass of the second bar. Applied force. Okay. And there's, yeah, that's a reaction. Let's just draw that one. Yeah. Okay. And label a few points. Let's call that A. B. C. And that is at the center of mass of that bar. These guys are equal length on the same plane, so that means that, hey, this guy's going to be theta 2. Do the geometry. All right. So, just assume we're going down our normal path. What do we need to do? Pick out some frames. I'm going to center one at A. Do X, Y that way. I need to figure out some other forces. Right. These kind of guys are constrained to move kind of in a slot kind of thing. Right, so we actually have AX, AY, CX, CY over here. And we could, if we wanted to, include gravity, say they're the same mass. But for this problem, we're just going to ignore gravity. So this is kind of laying in a plane or something like that. So gravity's not really affecting us. Okay, so what I'd like, some information, and it's kind of set up to show how this might work. A little bit of a contrived example, but what I want is information about this reaction force. So in the general case, right, this guy is free to move. I'm going to need to worry about all these different constraint forces. I'm going to need to know moments and this force, that kind of thing. I want to know maybe what I'm really after is, well, given this force, what's the reaction in X or something to that effect. Okay. But it's a static thing, right? So, okay, well, what I want to can set up is a set of virtual displacement, some virtual movement that's going to allow me to not have to worry about AX, AY, and CY, let's say. It's only going to contain the information that I'm really interested in figuring out. Okay, so what I'm going to do is say, well, hey, don't let point A move at all. Okay, but allow a virtual motion in the X direction only of point C. If I kind of pin this guy and do that, then well, theta is going to be changing as well. Okay, so I've kind of had this set of virtual displacements, and again, we're looking at a static case, but I'm going to have a virtual displacement, I'm going to let this end move a little bit in that x direction only. Okay. If I do that, I can set up this equation, I know it has to be zero, I can figure out what Cx has to be to allow that kind of motion, or for that kind of motion to occur. All right. So let's think about this. We have kind of really just one moment acting there, right? So the virtual, we have a moment. So we have kind of virtual work from the moment is what? Yeah, so we're going to let theta change, so we have a virtual displacement, virtual angular change about which that moment is causing. And it's kind of dotted or whatever. And they're both in the same direction. So we do get a scalar quantity there. Okay. We're going to need to know the virtual work done by F and CX. And, well, we could think about the other forces, but hey, we're not allowing this point to move vertically, so its virtual displacement there, zero, is one way to think about it, right? And we're not allowing this point over here to move, so the virtual displacement at A is zero, so those guys go away. Okay. So we need to know the virtual work. We need to know this kind of, some of the forces part of this equation. Okay. Well, let's start by writing position of C relative to A. Okay. And we could do some geometry and figure out that. And we can write the position of G relative to A as well. And again, we can do some geometry and simplify. There's numerous ways we could write this, but I'll stick with how Dr. Ginsberg did it. What's that? Okay. Well, if I want to find them, we're going to get to a generalized method for figuring out virtual displacements as well. But one way to think about it is, well, hey, I need to take, see how this changes as that, its variables change, basically, right? What's the, how can this thing change? Okay. And to do that, it's basically chain rule. Delta theta there. That. And so here, we'll see, another way to get at this is basically to write the velocity of those points and then just replace all the velocity components with virtual displacements. But in this case, we kind of work through this way. Okay. So then, I have the work from this guy. Now I have the virtual displacement of these. Well, okay, I'm going to write Well, let's look. We have first CX is in the I direction dotted with okay. So that's from CX. Delta. No, that has to be zero. Okay. And we can take that and figure out what CX has to be, basically, in order for that motion to occur. So the kind of key thing to take away is we basically just picked a displacement that's going to allow us to get to that force that we were interested in getting using these virtual displacements. Okay. The next section in the book, section 712, talks about dynamic virtual work. Okay. and it kind of corrects for having this zero on the right hand side. And you kind of have this idea of inertial forces, which I'm honestly not a fan of thinking about this that way. If that does make sense to you based on coming through Dr. Hippler's class, maybe you probably want to read section 712 in some detail. But basically allows us to go beyond the static case. I'm not going to go through it in detail in lecture because we're not generally going to work from the principle of virtual work. Right? For this to work, you have to know, right, kind of the motion of your system, right? Which is quite often and most often what we're trying to get to by modeling the dynamics anyway. Right? So it's one of those things where you have to know the answer to get the answer, which is generally not what, you know, not the direction we're going to be working for the most part for the rest of the term. I would also recommend this book. This part of the book is kind of text heavy. I think Dr. Ginsberg realizes that this virtual stuff is a little bit hard to understand, maybe. So I think he does a good job of explaining it in the actual text of the textbook. So if you're not reading the sections of the book, I would recommend that you actually, you know, do take a minute to read these sections. This whole beginning of chapter 7, talking about virtual displacements, virtual work. And of course, he has, you know, that was an example. This is an example from the book, so you can follow his description as well, compare it to what I did, and you know, get two viewpoints on that solution. Okay. Let's keep going. Okay. If I'm going to figure out, and what we're going to end up doing is using this idea of virtual work to get to equations of motion, or be a part of getting to some equations of motion, we need to think about a few extra other things. Make sure we have some clarity on our thinking there. So let's work through. We're going to talk about generalized coordinates, which I think is going to be pretty straightforward for you guys. And then we're going to talk about kinematic constraints, which actually does merit some discussion that you probably haven't seen before. And this is section 7.2 of your book. Okay. All right. Excuse me. So, generalized coordinates are basically the coordinates we're going to choose to use to model our system. What coordinates, what kind of coordinates are we using to describe the configuration of the system? Okay. So generalized coordinates, the set of coordinates we're using to describe the motion of the system. Okay. The degrees of freedom of a system are the minimum number of generalized coordinates you need to completely describe a system's configuration. So in general, we want the number of generalized coordinates to equal the number of degrees of freedom. That's the simplest set of equations we can come up with. It's going to be the simplest path towards the equation of motion, if we can get to that case. So let's just think about that really quickly. Say we have a random rigid body in a plane. Okay. How many degrees of freedom do we have? Random rigid body in a plane?
Three.
Right. So we have six in general space. If we're limiting it to this plane, we have three. All right. So I know I have 3 degrees of freedom. I want to try to pick a set of three generalized coordinates that would completely describe the configuration of this rigid body. Okay. What's a choice? Well, I need some kind of motion, right? I need to be able to describe, let's say, hey, maybe that's the center. Well, I probably can describe position that way. Position that way. Well, that doesn't quite give me enough. I need some kind of angle to describe this its angle, right? So I could do maybe – angle if I'm horizontal or something. So I have 3 degrees of freedom. I have now, that's three coordinates that would uniquely describe the configuration of the system. Okay. What other set could I use? What is another set I could use? Yeah, I could pick that same point and so I could use x, y, and phi. I could use theta and phi. Right. I could maybe measure, depending on what was going on, maybe I measured that angle that way. And I'm kind of belaboring this point a bit, but I want you to kind of internalize that I have a choice here. Right? And this is one of those things, like choosing the right coordinate frame, choosing the right set of generalized coordinates can really simplify a problem, the kind of pure math of working it out. Right? It's one of those things that will transform a 10-page problem into a 10-line one. So I think thinking kind of spending a little bit more time here than just the complete obvious choice can be worth your effort, at least as you're kind of developing some intuition about what coordinates make sense for a system. Okay. So, if I took this 3-degree of freedom system and said, well, okay, now it is pinned right here. So this point is fixed. How many degrees of freedom do I have?
One.
Just one now. Right? So I had 3 degrees of freedom in the free case. Right? If I pin this position, I'm limiting x is fixed and y is fixed. So I have two constraints then on the position of this point. So if I had n degrees of freedom minus 3 degrees of freedom minus two constraints, I have 1 degree of freedom now. And I could completely describe the configuration of the system using one of the angles. And we'll find that's generally true. The number of generalized coordinates we need, the number of degrees of freedom, is kind of the free number of degrees of freedom minus the number of constraints. Okay. So let's think about a slightly more complicated example of this. Take me just a second to draw this one, I think. So we have a bar on a collar. Let's call this guy A, that pin joint. We're going to call this pin joint B. Oh, that's going to be C, sorry. That guy's B. Okay, and these guys are different lengths. L1, L2. All right, so how many degrees of freedom does this system have?
Three. Well, should we look at it like as the entire system, like as a whole, or like each kind of component of it?
So the answer to that is what? What set of coordinates, what set of coordinates and degrees of freedom is the minimum size set to completely describe, unambiguously describe the configuration of the system?
stupidly describe it.
Okay. So what do you think we need? What are you saying we need?
So we need some... Well, actually, it might be more.
Okay. Let's draw up a frame. I think will help us to talk about this at least. So I'm going to put the centroid there. Just to match the book's drawing. And let's see. It actually draws it. He's actually drawn it this way. That's why I'm going to draw up some angles. I'm not saying that they're ones we need to use, but let's match the some distances and angles that would just allow us to talk about the problem at least. Again, I'm not saying that any of these are good choices. This angle theta, and that one's okay. So maybe starting with what we have up there, if you were thinking in this direction, what do I need to know to completely describe this? So you're saying if I know this length, which I do, and it's fixed.
Oh, you
use
theta
then. Okay, so theta would give me obviously the angle of that.
I think you need 5 total.
Okay, so what's your set of 5?
So if we know where A is and the X.
So that's our SA as we've drawn up here. Well, L1's a fixed quantity, so that we're not going to consider that as a generalized coordinate.
Okay, so then theta.
Theta.
And then your
t.
Yes. Which I guess you could, instead of describing it as V, you could describe it as some angle from the horizontal at V.
Okay. So you're saying 3. Okay. One recommendation so far.
But how would you get SC from that like that like location on that board?
Okay, so you think something like maybe the angles are defined from different places, but something like this. Yep.
I'm trying to think of what to call it, but I was doing L1 and L2 as two separate bodies, and then that slider limits 2 degrees, the other slider limits 2, and then the pin up top limits 2, so you need 6. My thought process.
So you're saying we need 6 degrees of freedom. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These lengths are fixed, is the kind of key there, right? So yeah, I can define phi in terms of theta, and these and one of these positions. So the minimum set is going to take two coordinates. Okay. So then if the minimum set's two, I actually can do, say, theta. I could do c and phi would get me there. I can do a and sc. If I know these two positions, right, and I know kind of the configuration of these guys too, right? These are known quantities, the orientation of those two bars. Well, if I know those two positions of those collars, I know these lengths, they're related. Right? Those are not independent quantities. Those angles are not independent of those positions of those sliders. And that's the key insight, right? Is that this is kind of the, you can think about the degrees of freedom, number of independent coordinates needed to completely describe a configuration, right? None of these coordinates, position of SC doesn't depend position of SA, right? Up here, phi depends on what SA and theta are. Right? Kind of the follow-up to that is that I could still use these if I wanted to form this set of equations of motion. And we'll see on Tuesday or maybe Thursday, depending on how things go on Tuesday, that sometimes I'm going to be forced to use a set of generalized coordinates that is larger than the number of degrees of freedom of the system. Yeah. So if you're looking at these sets, independent coordinates, or you'll see them called unconstrained. Right. Then any of these sets up here that are larger than the number of degrees of freedom are constrained sets of coordinates. I think that's probably a good place to stop because we're not going to be able to get through the next section in the time we have left. So I think this section of the course, right, is probably, I'm going to guess, you guys done a lot of Lagrangian stuff before? A lot of analytical methods? Vibrations, yeah. So I think, and even the Lagrangian stuff you saw in vibrations is kind of a small subset of what's possible in the Lagrangian and the kind of problems we're going to be solving. So I would kind of reiterate my recommendation that you, if you haven't been following along in the book and actually reading the book, that you do so. Like, there's a lot more, and you know, we can't get through every small detail that's in the book in the class time. So supplement with what I'm telling you with listening to Dr. Ginsberg as well. He's pretty good at this stuff.